So this deep dive is actually brought to you by CertFuel.
Yeah, they've got a really fantastic setup for test prep.
Right. It's a full Series 3 course, and they have like adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, all that good stuff.
And the unlimited practice exams are weighted exactly like the real thing, which is completely crucial for this.
Totally. You can check it all out at certfuel.com. So jumping right into today's topic, usually when we talk about rules and laws, there's this underlying expectation of precision, you know?
Oh, for sure. Like it's math or engineering.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like you run a red light, the camera flashes, you get a ticket in the mail. It's binary, red or green, stop or go. You cross the yellow line or you didn't.
Right, and it's comforting. We want to know exactly where the edge of the cliff is so we can walk right up to it without, falling off.
But then you step into the world of financial regulations, and specifically the rules for commodity pools and trading advisors.
Yeah, the traffic camera isn't just broken. It's been replaced by a committee that judges your intent and your font size.
It's the absolute definition of muddy waters. But that's exactly what we're going to untangle today. Because if you're listening to this right now, you are on a mission to absolutely dominate the Series 3 exam.
And we are targeting part two today, the regulation section.
And we need to be really clear about the stakes here. This isn't something you can just skim over on a Sunday afternoon.
No, absolutely not. Part two makes up 29% of the entire Series 3 exam. It's massive.
And here is the kicker. This is the part that gives people literal nightmares. It is graded as a completely independent section.
Yes, you need an independent passing score of at least 70% just on this regulatory part to pass the whole exam.
Which means you could be an absolute genius at market theory, right? You could
Right.
ace part one, nail every single complex hedge and math question.
Understand basis risk flawlessly.
Right. And if you get a 68% on regulations, you fail the Series 3. Just flat out fail.
The NFA doesn't publish the exact weights internally, but historically, this section is the beast that stops people at the gate. You simply cannot understudy this.
You really can't. But honestly, just reading a raw compliance rulebook is a one-way ticket to falling asleep.
It is so incredibly dry.
Right. So, to keep us awake and to help you actually retain this, we're going to use a recurring cast of characters today.
I love this approach. It makes the abstract rules feel like an actual story.
Exactly. So, I want you to picture these people because they represent the exact entities the exam is going to ask you about. First up, we have Paula the pool operator.
Okay, Paula, she's our CPO, the commodity pool operator.
Yes. Picture Paula syndicating capital. She takes money from dozens, maybe hundreds of different investors and pools it all into one giant, like, Delaware LLC.
Right, she's managing a fund. She actively solicits people to throw their cash into this collective pool so she can trade futures with massive combined capital.
Exactly. Then, right across the street, we have Tony the trading advisor. Tony is our CTA, commodity trading advisor.
And Tony is fundamentally different from Paula.
Completely different. Tony does not pool money. He doesn't have a giant syndicate. He just sits in a really nice office and gives highly specialized trading advice for a fee.
So he might have discretionary power over your individual account, or maybe he just publishes an expensive newsletter.
Right. And then finally, the most important person in this whole ecosystem, Dave the Daydreamer.
Ah, Dave, the client.
Dave is the prospective client. He's a successful guy, maybe a dentist with a lot of disposable income, but he has absolutely zero attention span for financial
He's
compliance.
easily distracted.
Yeah, so when Tony, the trading advisor, sits down to explain complex leverage to him, Dave is just staring at a fly on the wall. He's thinking about his golf game.
And that is exactly why these intense regulations exist in the first place.
Right, because Dave needs everything spelled out perfectly with massive warning labels, or he's going to lose everything without even realizing what he signed.
It comes down to the fiduciary burden of trust. Both Paula and Tony have their hands on the steering wheel of other people's financial lives.
Right, they are trusted with client capital in markets that allow for massive, ruinous leverage.
Exactly. Wherever there is public money involved, there is heavy regulatory scrutiny to prevent systemic fraud.
Which makes sense. If Paula has $3 million of my money, I want someone watching her. But before Paula and Tony can even talk to Dave, we have to understand who is actually writing the rules.
We need to talk about the regulatory bridge. If you don't get this framework, the rest of the rules will just feel like random trivia.
So who is the boss here?
Well, we have two major players, the CFTC and the NFA. the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. The CFTC is the federal agency. They write the actual federal law.
Okay, so they're in Washington, D.C., drafting the grand architecture.
Right, but they have a limited budget and limited manpower. They can't check if Tony is organizing his receipts in Chicago every week.
They can't audit everyone.
No. So that is where the National Futures Association comes in. The NFA is the industry's self-regulatory organization. They are the enforcers on the ground.
Okay, I love this dynamic. Let's use an analogy here. It's like a landlord and the city fire codes.
Let's hear it.
So imagine you rent an apartment. The city government, the CFTC, writes the fire code. They say you cannot have a propane grill on a wooden balcony.
Because it's a massive hazard, right?
Exactly. But the city fire inspector isn't going to check your specific balcony every Tuesday. So who actually checks?
The building manager.
The property management company. That's the NFA. And they take that city fire code and they copy-paste it directly into your private lease agreement.
Which is brilliant, legally speaking.
Right, because now if you put a grill out there, you aren't just breaking a distant city law, you are breaking your lease, and they can evict you.
That is a phenomenal way to look at it. The NFA doesn't rewrite a separate rule book. They adopt the CFTC's requirements to enforce them directly against their own members.
Breaking the CFTC's rule automatically breaks the NFA's rule.
Exactly. And, this is where the exam tries to get you. I want to explicitly flag this for you listening.
It's a huge exam trap.
The test will try to trick you into thinking the NFA and CFTC have two totally separate conflicting rule books. Like you have to follow one for document A and another for document B.
Right. They want you to think they're competing regimes.
But they aren't. Breaking the federal rule triggers an NFA violation.
Okay, but wait. If they just copy the federal rules, does the NFA have any unique rules of their own for Paula and Tony?
They do, actually. The NFA adds one very specific requirement for commodity pools. And remember, this is Paula's domain, the CPO side.
Okay, what is it?
The NFA requires a break-even analysis in the pool's disclosure document.
A break-even analysis? Why? I mean, a prospectus just tells you what the fund trades. Why add a specific math table just for Paula?
Because historically, commodity pool fees are structurally complex and incredibly opaque.
Like hidden fees?
Well, not hidden, just overwhelming. You could have funds that were technically profitable in their trades, but the client still lost money.
How does that happen?
The fee drag. You've got a 2% management fee, maybe a 20% incentive fee, brokerage commissions, execution fees, legal expenses.
Oh, wow. It's a massive spreadsheet of tiny cuts.
Exactly. And remember Dave, the daydreamer? He has no attention span for spreadsheets. If you hand him 8 different percentages, his eyes glaze over.
He's just dreaming about the Ferrari he's going to buy.
Right. So the break-even analysis forces Paula to translate all those costs into a single standardized percentage for Dave.
So what does that number actually tell Dave?
It tells him, Dave, this pool must earn exactly X percent this year in trading profits just to overcome the fees and get your account balance back to zero.
Jeez. So if the break-even is calculated at 15%, Paula has to make 15% in a volatile market just so Dave doesn't lose a dollar.
Precisely. It is a sobering dose of reality for the investor.
Okay, listener, let's think like a test writer for a second. If I want to trap you here, I'm going to offer a multiple choice answer that says the break-even analysis is a forecast of expected performance.
And you have to instantly cross that out.
Right. The break-even analysis is about fees, not forecasts. It is not a prediction. It's purely translating costs.
And again, it's an NFA overlay specifically for pools.
Okay, so Paula and Tony know the rules now. And they want Dave's money. But before Dave hands over a dime, he legally has to get a disclosure document.
Yes. The prescribed offering material contains all the risks, fees, history, everything.
And the most testable thing here is the timing.
Timing is absolutely everything with this document.
Okay. I want to test you, the listener, right now. Put yourself in this scenario. Tony, the trading advisor, has been wooing Dave. Dave finally says, I'm in. Can Tony get Dave to sign the legally binding contract on Monday and then hand him the dense disclosure document on Tuesday? Think about it.
That's a great question.
Right. Because if your gut instinct says Tony just committed a massive violation, you are exactly right.
You cannot sign a client to a binding agreement or take their money and hand them the disclosures later. The whole point is informed consent.
But the timing rules are slightly different for Paula the CPO versus Tony the CTA. And the exam loves testing them side by side.
Let's do Paula first. For a CPO, she must deliver the document to Dave no later than the time she delivers the pool's subscription agreement.
Right, which makes sense. Delivering it after he signs is like giving someone the ingredients list after they've eaten your mystery casserole.
It completely defeats the purpose.
Oh, you already ate the casserole? Well, it was full of unhedged counterparty risk. Hope you aren't allergic to total capital loss.
This slightly terrifying analogy, but yes, you need the ingredients before you take a bite.
Now, what about Tony, the CTA?
Tony's rule says he must deliver it no later than the time he delivers the advisory agreement.
Wait, that sounds identical. Paula delivers by the time she gives the subscription. Tony delivers by the time he gives the advisory agreement. Where's the trap?
The trap is the burden of proof. For Tony, just handing Dave the document isn't legally enough. He cannot enter into the agreement until he first receives a signed, dated acknowledgement of receipt from Dave.
Wait, really? He is totally paralyzed until Dave signs a receipt.
Completely. Dave has to physically or digitally sign a paper saying, I received this exact document on this exact date.
Why is the burden so much heavier on Tony?
Because Tony often holds discretionary trading authority over an individual account.
Yeah.
If Dave loses 80% of his net worth, his lawyers will instantly say, Tony never told us about the 20-to-1 leverage.
The signed receipt kills the he said, she said defense.
Exactly. It's absolute proof. If the exam says Tony can just keep a FedEx shipping receipt to prove he mailed it, that's wrong. He needs Dave's signature.
Lock that in. Tony needs a signed receipt before the contract, but what happens if things change? Let's say Paula gives Dave the document on Monday. But on Wednesday, a massive geopolitical event happens and Paula completely pivots her strategy to treasury yield spreads.
That's a material change. And it triggers the 48-hour rule.
How does that work?
If information is materially amended, Dave must have the corrected document in his hands at least 48 hours before his subscription is accepted.
So she can't just run over, slap the new document on his desk, and say, sign this right now.
No, she has to step back and let a mandatory 48-hour clock pick down. Dave needs a cooling-off period to digest the new casserole ingredients.
And the key word is material amendment, right?
Yes, if she fixes a typo, she doesn't freeze her business for 2 days. It's only for substantial changes.
Okay, so they deliver everything on time. But let's say I peek over Dave's shoulder and the document Paula handed him is, like, yellowing. The staple is rusted. It's been in her drawer for ages. Is that still valid?
Definitely not. And this brings us to the ticking clocks.
Yeah.
The document staleness rules. This is incredibly heavily tested.
I have an absurd visual for this because it's the only way I remember the numbers. Listener, I want you to imagine Paula's disclosure document is a refrigerator.
Okay, a big kitchen appliance.
Right. And you open the fridge door, and sitting inside is a gallon of milk. The milk represents the performance figures printed inside the document, the trading returns.
The fridge and the milk, I like it.
And they expire at completely different rates. The fridge itself, the business info, the structure that lasts a good while, but the milk inside. The market returns. That goes sour fast.
It's a perfect delineation. Let's attach the regulatory numbers to it. The fridge, the document itself, has a 12-month lifespan.
Okay, 12 months.
Right. Neither a CPO nor CTA can use a document dated more than 12 months before its date of use.
Huh.
At 12 months and 1 day, it's legally dead. You have to draft a new one.
But what about the milk?
The performance factors inside operate on a much shorter fuse. They must be current as of a date, not more than 3 months before the date of the document.
Or 60 days under that alternative method.
Yes, 60 days before distribution is the alternative, but 3 months is the standard baseline you'll see tested.
So why the two different clocks? Why not just make everything good for 12 months?
Because markets move too fast. The business structure, like who the CEO is, that's stable, that's the fridge. But imagine Paula made 20% in January and then lost 40% across February and March.
Oh, wow.
If she could use a 9-month-old track record, she could solicit Dave in October using only her brilliant January numbers, hiding the massive recent losses.
That would be like pouring Dave a glass of chunky, curdled milk just because the fridge is still under warranty. You can't feed a client toxic data.
Exactly. The dual clock rule forces the performance figures to stay fresh.
Listener, the exam is going to ask you, how old can the disclosure document be? And they'll offer 3 months, 60 days, and 12 months. Do not take the bait. Read the noun.
Pay attention to the noun.
If they ask about the document itself, the answer is 12 months. If they ask about the performance figures, it's 3 months or 60 days.
It's a classic misdirection.
Okay, so we know when it's delivered and how fresh it is. What exactly is Dave reading inside this thing?
The contents are highly prescribed. First is the 5-year background.
Wait, 5 years of what? Criminal history?
Close. It's the business background for the preceding 5 years of the firm and, critically, all of its principals.
So not just the CEO, the decision makers.
Right. If Tony was running a string of failed laundromats 3 years ago, Dave has a right to know that before handing over his net worth.
That makes sense. What else?
Fees and conflicts of interest. You need a complete, exhaustive description of every single fee in hard dollar amounts wherever possible.
Which feeds into Paula's break-even analysis.
Exactly. And then the conflicts of interest. For example, if Tony requires Dave to use a specific brokerage firm, and it turns out Tony's brother-in-law owns it and kicks back commissions.
Yeah, that's a massive conflict. Hey, Dave, my algorithm says trade 50 times a day, and oh, we split the commission. Dave needs to know that.
He absolutely does. Next is the trading program risks. Leverage, volatility, liquidity, counterparty risks.
But the part the exam loves the most is the cover page legend. Can you explain that? It's kind of counterintuitive.
It's a prescribed statement on the front cover. It must state that the CFTC has not passed upon the merits of the pool, nor have they verified the accuracy of the document.
Listener, huge red flag here. If the test gives you a scenario where Tony says, "Don't worry, Dave, the CFTC reviewed my document, so they officially approved my trading program."
That is a career-ending violation.
Yeah.
The legend explicitly disclaims the opposite.
Right. It's like the FDA nutritional label on a box of donuts. The FDA forces the bakery to say there are 500 calories per donut. But by putting the label there, the FDA is absolutely not endorsing you eating a dozen donuts for breakfast.
They're just making sure you have the facts before you make a terrible decision.
Exactly. A multiple choice option that says the CFTC approved it because of the cover page is 100% wrong.
Now let's talk about performance records. The difference between actual and hypothetical performance.
Oh, this is good. Side-by-side comparison time.
Actual performance is real money, real orders in a live market. You just close it straightforwardly. But hypothetical performance paper trading, back tests, that is treated like radioactive material.
Right, you need heavy disclaimers.
Uh-huh.
But I have to push back here. Let's say Tony spends millions building a perfect AI algorithm. He runs 2022 market data through it, and it proves it would have made 40%. The math is flawless. Why can't he just say he made 40%?
Hindsight bias. A paper track record is a simulation in a sterile lab. Tony is backtesting the algorithm knowing exactly when the 2022 market crashed.
So he can just tweak the code until it magically dodges the crash. Curve fitting.
Exactly. Hindsight makes any trading plan look like genius, and paper trading ignores slippage and liquidity.
Explain slippage for us.
In a simulation, if you sell 1,000 contracts of oil at $80, the computer assumes you got exactly $80 for all of them instantly. But in reality, dumping 1,000 contracts eats through the order book. You sell 10 at $80, 50 at $79.95. Your own massive order drives the price down against you.
So treating a backtest like real profit is a massive misrepresentation.
Yes. So regulators force a plain, inescapable warning on all hypothetical results, stating they have inherent limitations and were prepared with the benefit of hindsight.
Okay, let's do a pattern interrupt here. Wake up, listener. Dave finally stopped daydreaming. He signed the paperwork, wired the money. Now what? How do Paula and Tony keep track of all this?
Record keeping. It's the unglamorous backbone of compliance.
Who keeps what? Do they keep the same things?
No, it matches their jobs. Paula keeps the pools, books, subscriptions, redemptions, and a log of everyone's ownership share.
Because she's managing a giant syndicate, she needs to know how much profit belongs to Dave versus Diane.
Right. Tony doesn't pool money, so he keeps records of the specific advice he gives, the transactions he directs for individual accounts, and proof of his advertised performance.
And here's where it gets spicy. Bunched order.
Highly tested concept. A bunched order is when Tony places a single massive order for several clients at once.
So instead of hitting buy three separate times for Dave, Diane, and Derek, he just places one giant order for 300 wheat contracts. Is he just being lazy?
Not at all.
Yeah.
It's efficient, and it secures a uniform execution price. If he enters them separately, Dave gets a great price, but by the time Derek's order hits, the market moved.
Okay, it's like the office pizza order. Imagine Tony is ordering lunch for the three of them. Instead of three separate delivery fees and times, he places one massive pizza order. It's smart.
It is.
The problem isn't ordering the pizza. The problem is when the box arrives, who gets the perfect pepperoni slices and who gets stuck with the burnt crusts?
That is a phenomenal way to look at execution slippage. Because a bunched order for 300 contracts almost never fills at one single price. Some fill at $5, some at $5 a five.
So how do you hand out those differently priced slices to Dave, Diane, and Derek?
The NFA says the allocation methodology must be pre-established, objective, non-preferential, and verifiable.
Let's unpack that. Pre-established means Tony writes the rule down before he places the order.
Yes, before the market even opens.
Objective and non-preferential, meaning Tony can't say, Dave pays me a higher fee, so I'm giving Dave all the $5 fills and giving Derek the bad ones.
Exactly. Cherry picking is highly illegal.
And verifiable means an auditor can walk in a year later and prove Tony followed the math.
Spot on. Now, the allocation happens post-execution, but the advisor must review everything at least quarterly to ensure it's fair.
I bet the exam tries to trick people into thinking the act of bunching itself is illegal.
That is the exact trap. Bunching is legal. Cherry picking after the fact is illegal. You have to preset the rules for the pizza slices before the box opens.
But what if Tony uses a strict rotational system and just by bad luck, Dave gets the worst fill on a Tuesday? Is Tony in trouble?
No. Fairness is judged over time, not trade by trade. One unlucky fill isn't a violation. But if Dave consistently gets the worst fills month after month, that's a red flag.
Makes perfect sense. Okay, so Paula and Tony have a perfect compliance record. Now they want to run ads to find more Daves. What are the rules for promotion?
The golden standard. No misleading, deceptive, or high-pressure claims.
Okay, quick test for the listener. Tony runs a radio ad saying, futures trading is a proven way for everyone to build wealth. What rule did he break?
He broke the absolute prohibition against claiming futures trading is appropriate for everyone.
You just can't say that. Futures involve massive leverage. You can lose more than your initial investment. Saying it's for everyone is a massive violation.
Yes. The product is inherently dangerous to the uneducated investor. So you also have the balanced presentation rule.
Right. If you mention profit, you must give an equally prominent discussion of the risk of loss.
The fine print trick is a huge trap here.
Oh, like when Paula runs a magazine ad with a massive headline, earn 50%, and then microscopic 4-point light gray text at the bottom says risk of loss.
That's a blatant violation. The profit and the risk must carry comparable visual weight.
What about the disclaimers we talked about? Actual versus hypothetical. Do they apply to ads?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
For actual past profits, you use the standard. Past performance is not necessarily indicative of future results.
We've all heard that on TV commercials.
But hypothetical profits require the heavy disclaimer about inherent limitations and hindsight bias. You must compare those two directly for the exam.
Actual gets the simple disclaimer. Hypothetical gets the heavy one. Got it. So who ensures the marketing team follows this?
Supervisory review. The firm must review and approve all promotional material internally before it is used.
If the exam says they review it after a customer complains, that's completely wrong.
Yes. But for high-risk materials, internal review isn't enough. You have to submit it to the NFA's promotional material review team.
High-risk like what?
Audio or video ads, like a mass broadcast radio ad or a podcast that make a specific trading recommendation or tout specific profits.
So a generic radio ad is fine. But if Tony says, buy Cocoa Futures now, my algorithm made 20%, he has to submit it.
Yes, at least 10 days before first use.
10 days, that's an eternity. He can't just jump on a hot market trend. He has to wait a week and a half for the NFA to review the audio file.
It prevents high pressure manipulation on broadcast media.
Wow, the NFA does not mess around. They are the gatekeepers. Okay, we have covered a massive amount of ground today. Let's drop the energy into sheer focus mode. We're doing a rapid-fire recap of the top testable takeaways.
Number one, the NFA enforces CFTC rules. They are not separate regimes.
Number two, break-even analysis is exclusively for pools. Paula's domain. It translates fees. It is not a forecast.
Number three, Tony, the CTA, needs the signed, dated receipt of the document before the contract.
Number four, the ticking clocks. The physical fridge lives for 12 months. The milk inside lives for 3 months or 60 days. Don't mix up the nouns.
Number five, the CFTC cover page legend means they did not approve the merits of the pool.
Number six, bunch orders are legal. Cherry ticking is illegal. Preset the pizza slices objectively and fairness is judged over time.
And number seven, audio or video ads with specific profit claims go to the NFA 10 days in advance.
Boom. If you have those seven locked in, you will crush this section. But before we sign off, I want to leave you with a provocative thought experiment. We talked about how strict that 10-day NFA advance rule is for audio and video, right?
To prevent mass market manipulation.
But we live in an AI world now. As AI starts generating dynamic, highly personalized marketing copy or instantly backtesting algorithms tailored to Dave's unique browsing history, How do regulators enforce advanced supervisory review?
It's a huge question.
If an AI hallucinates a mathematically impossible profit claim in a personalized real-time email to Dave, who is legally on the hook, how does an analog 10-day advance review survive instant algorithmic advertising?
It's terrifying for compliance officers. The rules were built for a mass broadcast analog world. The framework has to evolve rapidly because protecting the client isn't going anywhere.
It's going to be wild to watch. But for now, you just need to know the rules as they stand today to pass. The regulations look like muddy waters, but once you map out the logic, it all becomes clear. Keep studying, use those CertCule practice exams, and go dominate that Series 3.